Modern Love, the podcast, is supported by...
Produced by the iLab at WBUR Boston.
From the New York Times and WBUR Boston, this is Modern Love. Stories of love, loss, and redemption. I'm your host, Meghna Chakrabarty. Last week, our team brought a live performance of the Modern Love podcast to the Provincetown Film Festival in Provincetown, Massachusetts. John Cameron Mitchell joined us for the performance. He created, directed, and starred in Hedwig and the Angry Inch. His new musical podcast is called Anthem Homunculus. Here he is, reading Effie Stempler's essay, Platonic, Until Death Do Us Part.
Recently, I stumbled across an article about Stephen Daldry, the man behind The Hours and Billy Elliot, who's openly gay and married his longtime friend, a woman and a director in her own right named Lucy Sexton. Now, Stephen, now 55, married Lucy at 41 because he wanted to have and raise a child and have health insurance. According to him, their relationship is not and never was romantic. It's a marriage rooted in practicality. How Fiddler on the Roof, I thought. And my next thought, how sad. Another gay man who can't fully accept himself. I recalled the Hollywood films I've seen about these men and their surrogate partners and how, in the end, the guy gets the guy, the girl learns her lesson, and the credits roll to some terrible Motown remake. I also thought about my gay friends with their husbands of 20-plus years and the unsolicited advice they often give to me about my own relationship future. Don't get too comfortable with her. They're talking about Marissa. We've been best friends for almost 17 years, having met at a party in New York City when we were 24. I was supposed to see if she was interested in my less courageous straight friend, a guy I had idolized in high school. Instead, I ended up boogieing with her and sparring wits for hours or minutes, I'll never know. She gave me her number on a napkin, closed my hand around it, looked at me in the eyes, and said, "Use this number. I'm serious. Don't throw this away." A week later, we bought tickets to Hawaii for Y2K. A few months after that, we became roommates. The roommate thing only lasted about a year since Marissa, unlike me, had no problem finding men to date long-term and eventually move in with. She ended up having two sons with different dads and even married one. But none of her relationships would last more than a handful of years, maybe because no one else in the world could understand us, entertain us, and inspire us as much as we could. Eventually, I began to wonder if the strength of our friendship was the thing undermining our romantic relationships. Countless self-help books on our respective nightstands counseled us to break free from our toxic patterns if we wanted to find lasting love. But what if our toxic pattern was how well we got along and how much we loved each other? Marissa rejected my toxicity hypothesis, insisting that we both had other friends and passions, lives that were enhanced, not dominated by how close we were. I tried to believe her, but it became harder and harder to accept. As the years passed, I was still the guy alone at the holiday parties and alone in my bed or the random beds of others I had met online or in bars. Ever the analyst, I grew concerned that we were addicted to the sugar that was our dynamic in order to avoid the protein of true intimacy. During Christmas with her family, I would flee to where her baby was sleeping and pummel myself with questions. Was I with Marissa because I was too lazy and scared to put enough effort into finding a partner? Were we using each other as placeholders? Was I afraid to grow up and love myself as a gay man? Was I just broken? Too many questions to answer in front of a baby monitor. At 37, I decided to leave New York and Marissa, the two things that seemed to keep me stuck in boyhood. I left my job as a high school teacher, moved to Thailand to teach ESL, live cheaply, and get the space I needed to figure myself out. I meditated with monks and cried on motorbikes. I began to see that I was more stuck than I had ever even thought. I had no idea who I was without my old crutches, Marissa, my various dating apps, and my romantic delusions. It was a lonely time. Every friendship I made was a faint shadow of the magnificent supernova that was my relationship with Marissa, and the dudes I met were increasingly older and hard-hearted after their own years of romantic frustration. After more than a year abroad, I followed some gluten-free breadcrumbs to San Francisco. When I told Marissa where I was headed, she surprised me by saying she had been planning to move to the Bay Area as well. I was slightly worried about my being in the same city as her again, but it seemed to me that as if the 16 months away from each other had renewed our mutual appreciation and made our friendship healthier. I was relieved to hear she was moving to Oakland, across the bay from me in San Francisco. It seemed like a good compromise to have her in my everyday life again, but not every day. For a while, I felt encouraged. I'd made it to the gay Mecca. Nothing would stop me from finding my bearded other half now. But if you want to make God laugh, make an OK Cupid profile. I went on tea dates with meditators, sex dates with polyamorists, friends dates that turned into sex dates with married men, and myriad unremarkable dates with both nice guys and jerks. None of them led anywhere. And Marissa had no luck either. Turns out your problems follow you, go figure. Then I turned 40, and I found myself in a state of crisis. Since being told at 18 that I was clinically depressed, I had faced many dark moments in my adulthood, a handful of which made me crash land for months or even years with one relative or another. Suddenly, I found myself again saying, this was not part of the plan, conveniently forgetting that I was never really in a plan to begin with. I couldn't move back in with my parents or siblings at this point, so I asked Marissa if I could stay with her for a while. It was yet another humbling moment in my life, sleeping on her sofa while her two little boys tried to get to the candy in Uncle Effie's prescription bottles. I felt laden with shame trying to figure out how I'd become that low-functioning middle-aged clown you see on sitcoms, the hairy interloping barnacle with an affinity for couches, the ambiguously gay uncle or gunkle, with a perpetual 5 o'clock shadow and an inappropriate joke. Who let the gunkle out? I would sing to Marissa's two-year-old, who would just stare at me blankly. Thanks to GlaxoSmithKline, I recovered quickly. After 3 months, I was ready to launch again, and then a funny thing happened. Marissa found a house in Berkeley with a yard, a treehouse, and a two-room unit in the back. She told me that she and her boyfriend at the time were parting ways, and she hoped I would consider being her long-term flatmate. Gunkle in the attic? I hissed, no way. For once in my life, I need to be an independent gay man. She rolled her eyes. Relax, Donna Mills. You can be an independent gay man with people who love you. Stop seeing yourself as the sad gunkle, and you won't be the sad gunkle. I couldn't argue with that. So I said yes. Of course, I plotted my next escape at the very hint of a challenge. But after a while, I began to do something I'd never done before, something that ran against every fiber of my angsty ancestry. I allowed myself to be comfortable. And my relationship with Marissa reached yet another level of love and respect. After 16 years as best friends and occasional roommates, we have become something else, something that doesn't seem to have a name. We joke that we are each other's PLPs, platonic life partners, and recall the promise we made in our 20s. If neither of us finds a husband by 40, let's get married. If only for the registry. We're now both 41, the same age as Stephen Daldry when he married his best friend, and we're both wondering what if he had it right. After all, the couples that I consider the happiest, mostly gay men who opened up their relationships decades ago, are not lovers as much as best friends. They know who should do the cooking and the dishwashing. They talk about their latest flings and support each other's biggest dreams. They get over fights fast and give each other prodigious amounts of space. They binge on Katy Perry when no one else is looking. They share an aesthetic and a language and a history that gives them strength to go on. I have all that with my best friend, and maybe the closest approximation of real love either of us will ever experience. And if the biggest concession is having separate beds, well, fine. I snore.
John Cameron Mitchell! And you read Effie Stempler's essay, Platonic Until Death Do Us Part. So what was it about this piece that you especially liked?
Well, in my podcast musical Anthem, I went back to my high school reunion for the first time in 35 years. And it was a very small school. There were just 6 people who came for the reunion. And 2 of them were my girlfriends from junior high and high school. One was a lesbian, you know, and happily married with a kid, and the other had a child as well, and she had gone through the Navy, and her name was Yvonne. And I wrote a character based on her called Yvette, who my character has a brain tumor, and he's doing a telethon to raise money to get it out on his phone. He's doing an app-based telethon, as we will all be doing. And, you know, his life is flashing before his eyes, and his ex-girlfriend calls in, and we have a long conversation, and we remember the song we used to dance to, which we wrote for the piece, which was called, the lyrics go, love me little, but love me long. I'm non-committal, but what's so wrong with that? And it's about the old-fashioned gay marriage, you know, fag and fag hag, the marriage that lasts. And she becomes uncomfortable with me saying, let's get married, I can get on your health care. And, you know, it's a painful scene, but it's also a very real one. And, you know, it can happen in any incarnation, you know, the gay woman, the straight guy, the gay guy and the gay woman, and you know, it not necessarily the sexual partners, but in every other way, perhaps a more stable relationship.
Well, John Cameron Mitchell,
thanks a lot.
Thanks again to John Cameron Mitchell for his performance. We'll catch up with Effie Stempler and Marissa after the break. Effie Stempler's essay was published in 2016. Not long after, he left the Bay Area and moved to Los Angeles to get his MFA in screenwriting at the American Film Institute. And just this month, he graduated. Marissa came to the graduation, and we asked her to join Effie in studio. Effie says that in some ways, their decision to live in different cities was about growing up.
Writing the essay was a way of me holding on to something that was disappearing very quickly. And not to say the love, I don't think the love was disappearing, but the shape of our friendship was changing. And I was holding on to the old shape of it. This really kind of popped the bubble of, frankly, illusion that I had about me and Marissa. Marissa didn't have that. She never wanted to marry me. And I never wanted to marry her, really. It was more like I was living with her. It was this very dreamy existence. She found this amazing place in Berkeley, and I just wanted it to be like that forever. when this came out, I realized somewhat painfully that we would always be friends, of course, but that she would eventually find the partner that she was always dreaming about. And I would have to continue working on my own dreams, which I didn't realize at the time involved writing and involved moving to Los Angeles and involved putting a lot on the line.
Since this essay was published, Marissa has found the strong relationship she was looking for, and Effie is pursuing a new career.
I wanted a real career. I didn't want to just dream of things in shitty jobs. I wanted a real family, even if it was just me and some plants. I wanted it to be mine, though. I didn't want to feel like I was attaching myself to somebody else's dream. And I actually do want a life partner. I'm open if anyone's out there. I'm still available.
And Marissa thinks her relationship with Effie is even stronger now.
I think we really struck balance, this beautiful ability to be there for each other, and also understanding that at the end of the day, we're on these solo journeys. No one can do it for you, not even your best friend of 20 years.
Although their lives have gone in different directions, Effie and Marissa have matching tattoos that Effie designed to honor their platonic life partnership.
So it looks like a soft pretzel missing one of its legs mm-hmm. on the bottom. I just looked at it, and we saw that he had figured out how to get a P and an L and a P into this heart, twisty little heart shape. And it was just so perfect that we knew. So that's it. We're getting it tomorrow morning.
And they're still thinking about how to commemorate a recent milestone, the 20th anniversary of their friendship.
Yeah, we're in talks. We're in talks. We're taking suggestions for tropical getaways. We'd like to go away for a few days. And really, I think it would be really meaningful and important for us to commemorate where we've been and where we are today. And in a way, I see us, especially with Effie graduating and both of us embarking on new chapters personally, that we are entering a new phase. And it'd be really nice to kind of metaphorically hold hands and walk into the sunset together.
That's Effie Stempler and Marissa Belger. Effie's recently written a film that's based in part on his essay. It's called Gunk. More after the break. Here's Daniel Jones, editor of the Modern Love column for the New York Times.
I'm always curious about people trying to figure out how to live their life according to expectations. And in Effie's case, you know, he struggles over and over in romantic relationships, but he's got this incredibly strong platonic relationship. And yet it feels like it's something you can't yield to. You know, it feels like giving into it is giving up on what kind of relationship you're meant to have. And then at the end of this essay, anyway, he does yield to it. That, you know, they decide to become roommates and still pursue other relationships. I just think it's an interesting essay in looking at expectations for life and when is that point where you decide those expectations are not what my life is meant to be. I thought that's what my life was meant to be, but maybe my life is meant to be something else, and sort of yielding to that and accepting the sort of blessings that you do have in your life.
Next week, Zachary Quinto.
The dog must have sensed my equivocation because suddenly, at a moment when I wasn't holding her leash properly, what did I know about holding a leash? She ran from us down a winding road that led to the Long Island Expressway. It was horrifying. How did those stubby legs carry her so fast? Ira chased her running in the middle of the road faster than I've ever seen him run. Help, he yelled. I need help. Get the car.
Modern Love is a production of The New York Times and WBUR, Boston's NPR station. It's produced, directed, and edited by Caitlin O'Keefe. Original scoring and sound design by Matt Reed. Thanks to Lisa Viola and the whole team at the Provincetown Film Festival, and to musicians Roxanne Layton and Peter Chiluzzi. The idea for the Modern Love podcast was conceived by Lisa Tobin. Iris Adler is our executive producer. Daniel Jones is the editor of Modern Love for the New York Times and advisor to the show. Additional thanks to Julia Simon, Anya Stremian, and Mia Lee at the New York Times. Additional music courtesy of APM. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. See you next week.